Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. This morning, in this hour, we will return to a subject that we like to talk about, and that is language. From time to time, we have guests on the show. We have a friend here in the English department who is a frequent guest. We talk with others. We talk about language, how it changes, how sometimes that annoys people, how the words that we use, what they have to say about our time and our place and who we are and how we think about ourselves and how we think about the world. And those are certainly all questions of interest to our guest for this hour of the show, Jeffrey Nunberg. He's a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at University of California at Berkeley. He's also chairman emeritus of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary and is a frequent commentator on language and politics for National Public Radio. He's been a regular on the NPR program Fresh Air and also in the Sunday New York Times and many other publications as well. He has authored a number of books, including Going Nuclear, Talking Right, and The Way We Talk Now, and a new collection of his writing. This book is titled The Years of Talking Dangerously, and it is published by Public Affairs Books, just out now in the bookstore. I'm sure you can find that and his other books in the bookstore or the library if you would like to read them. And as we talk, people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation with whatever questions, comments that you have. The only thing we ask is people try to be brief, just so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible and keep things moving along. But certainly questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. We'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments are welcome. Professor Nunberg, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. You know, I thought I'd begin with the notion that for linguists, it's something that they would say, well, of course, that's the case. But people who aren't, maybe when you say it, they will scratch their heads and say something like, well, what exactly do you mean by that? And here it is. That is that the power to name things, to decide what things are called, what word you're going to use, is a great power indeed, because that shapes the way that we see the world.
Well, sure, it does. If you think of experience as this sort of undifferentiated kapok, like a sleeping bag, language comes along and so seems in it. So we classify things somewhat arbitrarily sometimes into categories in a way that it wouldn't be. It's hard to imagine what it would be like to try to see the world without language. But so language does that, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is too sweeping a statement, but I'm inclined to even go as far as to say something like, until you have a name for something, it is almost as if that thing actually doesn't exist.
Well, or I wouldn't go that far, because you don't want to think of yourself as a prisoner of language. Let's just say you're an internee. You're under house arrest, but you can slip out into the yard. There's a line of W.H. Auden I always like. The one notices if one will trust one's eyes, the shadow cast by language upon truth. And I think that's how it is. I mean, we ordinarily think in terms of the categories that language provides to us. But we can, sometimes by trusting our eyes, by dint of effort, step outside and see the world at least from a different point of view. Otherwise, it wouldn't be possible to learn a foreign language, which has different categories, because you'd be just a prisoner of your own.
You say that every age, and I guess here that we're talking about, I suppose we could be talking about decades or other ways of dividing up history. We could talk about, particularly if we're talking about political language, presidential administrations. Every age has a characteristic kind of language that defines it. And that you've also said that the pieces in this book are, the phrase you use is a snapshot of language over the last part of the Bush era. So having said all that, at that point, and maybe we can talk about how perhaps things have started to change. But if you look at that that point in American history and politics, what kind of language defined the last part of the Bush era?
Well, I think the as I say, every language, it isn't as if eras aren't rich with all kinds of language. If you look at what's going on around, you have the language of technology, you have the language of these vague sensibilities that are floating around in the air that it would be hard to put a finger on if we didn't have names for them, things like snarky and so on. And the language of real estate, let's not forget, and the language of economics, and so forth, and the language of politics. Now, I think that over the past 5, maybe 10 years, the language of politics has been dominant, so that when we look back on this decade, we'll recall it as the language of the second. We'll recall it as a language of politics, in the same way that when we look back on the language of the '60s, we think of the language of sex and drugs and disaffiliation. And when we look back on the language of '70s, we think of new age language or teenager slang, the Valley Girl slang. In the '80s, it's the language of tech and so on. '90s, language of tech and so on. So each age does have, at least retrospectively, a characteristic language. And I think of the last 10 years. For lots of reasons, it will be the language of politics. The language of politics, because it's an age in which people have had an intense interest in politics, in part due to 9/11, in part due to reactions to the Bush administration, and now, of course, the Obama administration. In part because it's an age in which people have become very conscious of language as a political force. All this talk about framing and messaging and so forth is a sign of just how aware people have been or self-conscious about the political language they use. So, yes, that's how this age will be remembered. Mm-hmm.
Well, can you give some kind of example that would illustrate that?
Well, there are a couple of things. If you think back to the Bush administration, there's this characteristic language that the administration used. There's, I think, never been an administration, or at least not since Roosevelt's first term, that was so skillful and adroit early on in its use of language. And you think of all the phrases, for instance, that were used in connection with Iraq. Bring them on. When they stand up, we'll stand down. Islamofascism, and of course, mission accomplished aboard the USS Lincoln. What was that in 2004? I'm losing it now. And then there's the language of domestic policy, compassionate conservatism, the ownership society, and so on. So when you think back on that administration, you think back of this set of slogans, all of which fell apart in the last 2 or 3 years of the administration. It was a real linguistic meltdown, which is one of the things I try to document in the book, and is very interesting. It speaks to the point we were talking about earlier, that language can patch over reality or obscure reality, but at a certain point, when the mismatch is too great, reality starts to intrude, and language starts to, as it were, tear at the seams.
Just, you know, I find myself wondering whether part of the problem with politics today is that it has been reduced to a battle of bumper stickers. And I was struck by your talking about, I looked at a talk that you gave where you mentioned the quip of Joe Klein, who said the problem with the Democrats is that, or maybe the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is the Republicans have better bumper stickers. And I think the problem that we face now is that politics, political discourse, has essentially come down to a battle of bumper stickers. Has it always been thus, or is there something about our time now that's made that worse, do you think?
Well, you know, I think it really has always been that way in one way or another. Back in 1922, I think it was, Walter Lippmann wrote a very influential book called Public Opinion, in which he talked about the way in which political symbols, these are these word symbols, work to create solidarity by, as he put it, assembling emotions after they've been detached from their ideas, right? And I think that's still true. It was true then, and it's true now, that the world is a little too complex for us. The facts, as Lippmann said, exceed our curiosity. And we do inevitably think of the world, whether it's politics or anything else, in terms of what cognitive psychologists call cognitive shortcuts. And these slogans and bumper stickers do that work. In a way, they make for efficient thinking. They can also make for distortion and oversimplification and sometimes downright just misalliance between words and the world.
You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that different time periods have characteristic language, and that the language that you're arguing really defines the Bush era is the language of politics. One wonders about the role that the media plays in all this, and people think that the media sets the agenda, and the media has a tremendous impact on language, and certainly it does. We might propagate it, but I'm not so sure that it starts with us. And so that makes me wonder, well, where does it start? In this particular case, does it indeed start in the White House, or maybe it, with other important cultural institutions? Maybe that's where it starts. And does the news media simply just pass it along?
Well, I think it's a little of both. I think certainly in recent years, it's been not so much the media, but the phrase mongers or phrase makers on either side who coin a lot of this stuff and float it. And the media has been actually rather passive in accepting the language of whatever administration or whatever group happens to be dominant, happens to make the most noise, and just passing it along. You look at, for example, and this is again about the Bush administration, the way that the Bush administration decided during the Social Security reform period that they wanted to rename these accounts not private accounts but personal accounts. And if you look at the media, the incidence of that phrase, private accounts, dropped by half, and the incidence of personal accounts increased by half. They just passed it along. And this has been the way the media have responded over a long period of time. It's also the case that people who have a particularly persuasive phrase or meme in the modern jargon are very successful at passing it along to the media. I think the media will pass along whatever's either given to them by the talking heads or the administration or the think tanks or whoever it is, or whatever sells the best, whatever's jazziest, and so on and so forth. So a phrase like, for example, death panels is irresistible, even if it's put in quotes and so on and so forth. It has a ring, and the media will just pass it along. The media are more interested in selling soap than in getting to the truth of things. And those are jazzy titles, jazzy names that are easily disseminated.
Yeah, and that, I guess, is something that discourages me a little bit because I think certainly there are people who would argue that this kind of language, particularly this kind of political language, it's not value neutral, and that I'm not sure that we're doing anybody a great service simply by repeating it as said without making any sort of comment about the various shades of meaning that get attached to the particular words or phrases that an administration would choose to use.
I think that's right. And I think the media have, in the name of objectivity, reduced themselves to the position of just passing along the language of both sides of an issue and at that point saying, well, we've discharged our duty. Or in avoiding phrases that are in any way controversial. And I think NPR is a very good example of this. This is not just true of Fox News or of CNN, whichever side, but NPR, in, for example, refusing to use the word torture to describe what went on in Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib, because, as they say, well, it's controversial. Some people say it is torture. Some people say it isn't torture. So it's we are discharging our responsibilities. This is the NPR ombudsperson speaking. We're discharging our responsibilities by refusing to use that word. Now, this at a time when the press and the media in every other country in the world have been using the word torture. And I'm speaking not just of the left-wing press, but the right-wing press. You look at Murdoch's papers in the UK and Australia, they're calling it torture. Berlusconi's papers in Italy are calling it torture. The right-wing papers in Germany and France are calling it torture. And only the American media don't want to use the word because, after all, it would be controversial and hence compromise the objectivity of the media. So I think the objectivity can be often a mask for refusing to do your duty, to do your job as a journalist.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Jeffrey Nunberg. He's a linguist. He teaches at the School of Information at University of California at Berkeley. Is often heard doing commentary on language and politics on NPR's Fresh Air program. His work has also appeared in the Sunday New York Times and many other publications. He is the author of a number of books, and his most recent is a collection of writing about language. That is titled The Years of Talking Dangerously. Public Affairs is the publisher. Questions, comments, certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here, someone on a cell phone from up around Aurora, the northern part of the state. We'll go right there. Line four. Hello.
Yes. Good morning to your guest also. You know, everybody's afraid of stepping on each other's toes. I think it's funny when you watch all these commentative shows on TV and hear them on the radio, that a lot of people are avoiding saying things that we used to say on a regular basis, say 20, 30 years ago. I think the media in general has thrown that scare tactic out there. I noticed the difference between here and Europe, and then knowing if you watch, for instance, the BBC or any of those European channels, which I get, the format is a lot different, and they're speaking, they're just in general talking about things that you wouldn't talk about here. What's your comment on the BBC and other European channels versus American media? And I'll get off. Thank you.
Well, what do you think?
Well, you know, the media I know are the British, French, and Italian media, and they're in certain ways much. They do go in greater depth, particularly on television. Into issues, they have more discussion programs, and they have in prime time. They allow themselves a greater range of language in describing things. They don't have the qualms that the American media have about using certain kinds of words. I agree with all that. On the other hand, in those countries, the tradition of objective journalism, whatever it may have come to in America now, isn't generally as strong, particularly in France and Italy and Germany. There's a tradition that the media are owned by the government or by opposition parties, and to a certain extent reflect the views of those parties. Now, you can say, some people say that's a good thing. There are people who in the States say objectivity's finished. And this is something you hear particularly from the right. What you want is people who wear their political position on their sleeve. This is the Fox position. People at the Wall Street Journal have said the same thing, and that rather an honest conservative than an honest liberal than somebody who pretends to be objective. And this is a view you hear a lot of now, and it's in a way of objectivity, of undermining the very idea of objectivity. And I find it troubling, but it's certainly a view you hear a lot nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that the kind of things that I hear some of the most high-profile political commentators in radio and in television saying, it doesn't look to me like they're afraid to step on any toes. It looks to me like they are delighting in stepping on toes. You know, when you have somebody who works for a major cable news outlet sitting in front of the camera and saying that he thinks that the President of the United States is a racist, that's a pretty big toe to step on. It seems to me that there's very little hesitancy among at least some of the most vocal people to say whatever they want.
Right. I think you put your finger on an important point. But people say, oh, things that there's more invective, there's more vituperation, people are nastier now than they have been. And it's true, this stuff waxes and wanes. On the other hand, if you go back to the 1930s and look at what they were saying about Roosevelt or what they were saying about Woodrow Wilson or what they were saying about Lincoln, they were every bit as over the top as people are now. I think the difference is, and this is what I think you were speaking to, is that for the first time, there's a business model built around this stuff. Now, there are people who have learned how to sell 24/7 invective, vituperation, political calumny, and you can turn on your radio or your television, and just any time you want 40 minutes of vilification of the administration, say just turn on your radio. This is new. And it's turned it into an explicit form of entertainment. And, of course, for the purpose of entertainment, what you want is stuff that's vivid, that's over the top, that's extreme, that's exaggerated. And thoughtful, nuanced, middle-of-the-road considerations don't have the entertainment value that this other stuff does. So I think for purely almost economic reasons, the media have been driven to these extremes.
Well, you know, I think you make a very interesting point. It's actually something that I've been thinking about myself lately. In respect to some of the most high profile political commentators, and I'm not just talking about conservatives, because there are figures who are liberals who do the same, that are doing political and social commentary. But I've now come to think more and more that what they're doing is a kind of performance art, and that it's not so much about politics or social issues as it is about them. And though one can say that, and yet at the same time, people like that can have a great deal of influence and can have a great impact on what people think about political and social issues. So I suppose you cannot really divorce their performance from its political impact.
I think that's absolutely right. It is a kind of performance, and it reduces politics to a kind of a neighborhood drama, if you will. Everything becomes about, if you're listening to conservative radio, for example, where I think this is most fully developed, mm-hmm. It becomes a little drama about the liberals down the street, the jerks, in a book I'm writing, I'm using a stronger word than that, around the corner, the pretentious, self-important, supercilious, out-of-touch liberals around the corner, like an uncle that you can't stand. And what's interesting, if you listen to, and again, this is particular right-wing radio, but it works as well for the left, as you say, is the way in which all issues have to be reduced to that. So, for example, if you listen to Fox News stories about Iraq in the months leading up to the Iraq invasion, you found that over two-thirds of those stories mentioned France or the French. Now, why did they do that? Why was this as much a story about France and the French as it was about Iraq? Because Saddam Hussein was this remote, villainous creature. And what you wanted to do was reduce it to somebody more familial, not just the French, but the supercilious liberals who were fond of the French. And in that way, every story becomes a story about this. I remember listening to Hannity and Combs at one point, and they were talking about Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson was alive, obviously. And Hannity said, what kind of people would let their kids share a bed with Michael Jackson? And Combs says that, and Hannity shoots back, liberals. That's what this radio is all about. That's what these shows are all about.
Let's talk with someone else here. We have a caller in Chicago, line number four. Hello.
Use of words can be down to earth and rather high and mighty. I'm thinking of the late William Buckley and, of course, some other people who have elevated the use of language to a point where you almost have to turn to a dictionary to grasp, unless you can grasp the context in which you're talking. But actually, the impact of words is what I'm interested in, because some of them don't seem to carry the force that I felt some of them should, like collateral damage. What does it imply in what we understand, or triage and so forth? They don't, or even the word pornography, you know. Professor at the University of Chicago wrote a book called The Pornography of War, and others. The impact of words sometimes falls into common usage or archaic, depending upon who's handling it. But language that really strives and carries an impact upon which you're expressing it is the thing that I find so important and is somewhat lacking. To the point where now we have the vituperative, vociferous language that's being bandied around by Rush Limbaugh and the like, and then others who are, Obama's gift and other Bill Clinton's capacity have been great, as well as other predecessors. So I just started sort of it as an observation, and how the importance of word can be over the top, or just not encompassing the full impact that it may express. Thank you.
All right. Well, you can reflect on that any way you like.
Well, yeah. I think of Eliot's line, I got to use words when I talk to you. And There are a couple of themes there, but one certainly is this use of euphemisms. And in a certain sense, euphemisms have always been with us. You think even back in classical Roman times. But it's really, in a certain sense, particularly in politics, a modern phenomenon. You might say it began with the French Revolution. It was already active at the time of the Crimean War, for example, when the word casualty, which had meant an accidental loss, became a euphemism for the dead and wounded. But in modern times in particular, we've seen this explosion of euphemism. The caller mentioned collateral damage or the others that have been used in Iraq and in the Second World War in Vietnam and so forth. What I think is interesting about these euphemisms is, and again, this comes back to the point we were talking about earlier, is that they don't last for a long time. Euphemisms, I think of as sort of like the covers that you throw over chairs and sofas that ultimately take the form of the furniture they're supposed to conceal. And a phrase, for instance, like I mentioned casualty already, a phrase like ethnic cleansing. Or concentration camp, which began as a euphemism, after a certain period, no longer has that euphemistic character, that ability to conceal the nature of the thing it's applied to, and then you have to reach in and pull out a new euphemism. It's like the applying new coats of floor wax as the old one's yellow. So, in a certain sense, although euphemisms are a characteristic linguistic evil of our times, they're also an indication of how ultimately we're not the prisoners of language. And when the discrepancy between language and the world grows too great, the world does show through. Language begins to tear.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and we are talking this morning with Jeffrey Nunberg. He's a linguist. He teaches at the School of Information of the University of California, Berkeley. He is Chairman Emeritus of the Usage Panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. His commentaries on language and politics have appeared regularly on NPR's Fresh Air and in the Sunday New York Times. He's authored a number of books. His books include Going Nuclear, I like that title, Talking Right and the Way We Talk Now, and his most recent collection of his writing on the subject of language. The most recent is titled The Years of Talking Dangerously. It is published by Public Affairs. Questions are welcome, 333. Questions, comments are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here is another caller, someone on a cell phone in Champaign, line one. Hello. Oh, yes.
Thank you for taking the call. I certainly appreciate it. I just recently read the Lakoff book on Whose Freedom? And that points out that the Bush administration was quite good at shifting the meaning of words, not just coining a phrase that became useful, but changing the frame of reference. Do you agree with Lakoff? And he was feeling that the conservatives were winning the battle as to the concept of freedom. Do you agree? I'll listen off the air.
All right.
Well, I think the word freedom is certainly the most important and dominant word in American political discourse from the founding to the present day. And no group, no party, no movement has ever been able to achieve dominance in American political life without controlling that word. So it's always the ground on which these issues are fought. And it goes back and forth. Roosevelt, for instance, was a master, created in a certain sense the modern sense of freedom with his four freedoms and adding to freedom of speech and the freedom of religion, freedom from want, freedom from fear, which extended freedom into the economic area. Reagan pushed back with these other freedoms, the economic freedom, the notions of economic freedom, that involved freedom from government regulation, freedom of choice, which the right has used for everything from any kind of the right, basically of workers, for instance, to work for companies that don't provide adequate health care, the right of employers to treat their employees however they like. Freedom of association has been used to justify segregation. So these themes of freedom play on both sides, also reproductive freedom and so forth on the left. So in one way or another, everybody tries to claim freedom. Now, I think Bush continued the Reagan theme and used freedom very skillfully and broadly to justify a range of programs. But there are other notions of freedom, and the left and liberals have been able to deploy them as well. So I think this is still being fought out. I don't think either side owns freedom, and it's not a word that one side can own in perpetuity. It's always going to be a contested concept.
You know, there would have been a time, even just a couple of years ago, when we would have had to say that the right had succeeded in capturing the linguistic high ground. And I think you've said that you feel that the Bush regime was as much a linguistic one as a political one. But then if you look at the end of the Bush administration and last year's election, I think then you would also have to say that it just wasn't working for the right anymore. The kinds of language they were using that had been successful, it had started to fall apart. Why do you think that happened?
Well, I think it fell apart. There are really two separate collapses. The one is the collapse of the particular language of the Bush administration. If you look at the last 3 or 4 years of that administration, it was basically nothing but a series of slogan recalls. Wanted dead or alive morphed into we don't know where he is and really we don't care. 2006, you think of Bush telling George Stephanopoulos, actually, we've never been stay the course. A reversal so dramatic that even Fox News couldn't resist playing all the clips of Bush saying stay the course. And of course, Bush himself, just after the 2008 election, asked if he had any regrets, said, well, some of the things I said, for example, mission accomplished, I could have expressed myself more artfully. I like that very much, as if it were merely a question of artlessness. I guess it was artlessness in a way. He might have saved himself a lot of trouble if he'd said something more noncommittal like, way to go, guys. But what really happened with that language, both in domestic and foreign policy, was that the discrepancy between the words and the things just became too great. The other collapse, which ultimately is still with us, and is the collapse in the 2008 election of the culture war language with which the right had managed to dominate American political discourse since really Nixon and Agnew and the Southern strategy of the late 60s. I don't think there's ever been, particularly Palin, but also McCain, there's never been a Republican campaign that so explicitly wielded these themes, palling around with terrorists, the pro-American parts of this country, and so forth. And it just went nowhere. Now, you can say, the people who had been swayed by that language just weren't going to go there. Now, you can say economic issues trumped those cultural issues, but those issues have always been around, and the economic and cultural. And this is the first time in recent years that the cultural campaigns just haven't worked. Now, you can say they're back. Look at what's going on with the town halls and so on and so forth. I think that's deceptive. It may be that these people have succeeded in persuading a lot of people that to be nervous about the various health plans out there, particularly the House Democrats' plan. And that may, in fact, succeed in derailing certain provisions of those bills. I don't think there's any question we'll have a health care bill. But I think if you listen to this language, it's language aimed at the rump. The word socialist, for example, which these people are yelling and screaming and so forth, is a word that used to be at the center of Republican political rhetoric, not a single Republican campaign convention could take place without somebody yelling up about the socialistic plans of the Democrats or creeping socialism, so much so that Harry Truman said in 1952, when you hear a Republican, 1948, when you hear a Republican say, down with socialism, what he really means is down with progress. Now, that word disappeared from Republican discourse, and it's been revived now. But it's a strange word in a certain sense. It's a strange word because the only time you hear it used, the phrase socialized medicine is one of those idioms. I think most people now hear socialized only in the context of medicine, the same way you hear cran only in the context of cranberry. And when you look at surveys, you find that more Americans think socialized medicine would help American health care than hurt it. That isn't to say they know what socialized means. It's just to say that that language, while it has the power to adrenalize what remains of the rump of the right and to make a lot of noise, it is not persuasive with the larger American electorate. And I think that the cries of fascism and Stalinism and so on and so forth, they adrenalize the right. They speak very well to the audience of these people like Beck and Limbaugh and so on. But they are not the linguistic strategy whereby Republicans can recapture the center of the American electorate that any party needs to return to power. Hmm.
The last president, Bush, was often criticized, sometimes mocked, for his use of language. The current president is certainly much more skillful in his rhetoric than President Bush. What sort of thoughts do you have about President Obama and his manner of speaking?
Well, Obama is obviously, you should excuse my saying, very articulate. Biden got in trouble for using that word, but he is an extraordinarily articulate and clear speaker. Bush was not, although Bush did very well what Bush was good at doing, and I think Bush got a kind of a bad rap about his grammatical missteps and so on and so forth. I personally don't care a lot if somebody is speaks a little ungrammatically. It isn't a criterion I use in choosing a doctor, or a stockbroker, or a lawyer. I don't see why it's particularly important in choosing a president. But Obama, for all his skill, has failed up to now to create a language that can be used by other Democrats to justify their programs. The brilliance of the culture wars language of the Republicans, these words like values and bias and patriotism and so on, is that they could be deployed not simply by relatively charismatic politicians like Bush or extremely charismatic politicians like Reagan, but by these characters like Mitch McConnell and John Kyle and so forth, people who are not only uncharismatic but maybe anti-charismatic, and yet they could push these buttons and get the same response. From Obama, we haven't had any language like that, so that I don't see yet the beginnings of a new language of American liberalism or neoliberalism or post-liberalism, whatever you want to call it, that will be able to supersede the language with which Republicans have managed to move the center of gravity of American political language to the right.
Mm. Well, do you think that that's something that is necessary for people on the left to be successful?
Ultimately, yes, I do think that. I think that we're going to start to see the seeds of it in 2010, something I think like a new populism. And by the 2012 election, it'll be there. The one thing I think one can say with confidence is that American political language will change more over the coming 10 years than it has over the last 50. Hmm. The old language of the cultural war language is dead in the water, although it'll be changed and made more political. Other things will happen to it, but it's dead in the water as it was. The language of the Democrats right now remains a kind of a wonky policy speak, and they have not yet come up with the seeds of a new populist language that can work for them electorally at a national level. So I think we'll see something very interesting happening, but I don't know what it'll sound like.
All right, let's talk with someone else. Someone on cell phone here, line one. Hello.
Hi, I missed part of the discussion, so if this has been covered, forgive me. But the discussion is talking about the language of politics, and much of it is how successful the right has been with their characterizations of liberals and managing the language. But this seems to be taking place without the context of the background of like a huge, massive movement, lots of think tanks, lots of politicians being trained with exactly what to say. Radio stations going back from Limbaugh in the 1980s, you know, and then seeing that the liberals have made an effort starting in, what, 2003? And to talk about that just kind of implies that, you know, the Republicans are just better at it, the conservatives. Even this guest has come out and quoted half a dozen of the things that people say about liberals, but not mentioning, you know, the stereotypes that, that people have for conservatives, the rash, violent, or even, you know, stupid stereotypes. It's like, even in the context of this discussion, we're not talking about the why or what what's being said on the right, to the right. So that's all.
I think the point's very good. There are two points you made, and I think they're both well taken. The first is that the right's success in using language hasn't had to do only, or even maybe chiefly, with the ability to coin these memorable phrases, but with the Republicans' ability to coordinate their usage, the congressional delegations, the White House, the think tanks, the right-wing radio and television hosts, all being on the same page. And you can certainly hear that in the way, for instance, the phrase government takeover has just been picked up by everybody, and it is being used to characterize the health plan. The Democrats have never been as good at that. They may be getting better, but I don't think they'll ever achieve the success that the Republicans have, just because the Republicans are generally more cohesive unit group. The other point that you made is that we're not talking about the characterizations of conservatives, and I think that's right. They're traditionally a characterization of conservatives as a small town, uneducated, uncultured, slightly vulgar, walking around New York, as a writer for New York Magazine said, when the Republicans are there in their drab suits and dresses and so forth. There are a number of these characters. There's also the white shoes Republicans, the country club Republicans, and so forth. So there are all these stereotypes. They've been there for a long time. I certainly think the media have done something by way of promulgating those, and that the attempts, for example, to characterize the town hall, let me call them protesters, as merely astroturf automata and so on and so forth, misses the interesting point of what's really going on out there. That said, I think that the Republicans have been more successful than the Democrats, or the right more successful than the left, at producing a certain kind of political stereotype, a personality stereotype, that has been influential in shaping the notion of what how political divisions are created. So when you look at these liberal stereotypes, the Volvo-driving, the Hollywood-loving, body-piercing, so on and so forth, liberal stereotype, that's one that really has influenced the way people talk about politics in a way in which the left stereotypes of the right haven't.
Our guest, Jeffrey Nunberg, is a linguist. He teaches at the School of Information at University of California at Berkeley. His most recent book, a collection of writing about language, The Years of Talking Dangerously, published by Public Affairs. We have about 5-6 minutes left. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think we have a Chicago caller. Maybe you might like to make an additional comment here on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I wanted to get back on the matter of words that are written and talked about as a result of a speechwriter who certainly has been gifted in that capacity. And we've seen Peggy Noonan and others in the past who have gone from speech writing for President Reagan right on to the recently aspiring Sarah Palin. And it should not be forgotten that those words certainly don't really reflect the true aspects of the recent candidate to the vice president. Of course, she's become the food and fodder for Saturday Night Live as a result of things she says without the handling of the speechwriter. And then you have the other day Senator McCain saying how he would not choose to vote for Supreme Court Justice Sotomayor because she was an ordinary woman. And all the implications that he may want to bear with that. So the speechwriters quite often can toe the line for the party. And then on the other hand, when you figure out they're making $500-$600 or more dollars for an hour or a day or whatever, then you can see that they're being well paid. But then you have the other matter of like the one with the Republican noise machine. Talking how when someone was asked to write a book about Hillary Clinton. The person that commissioned the book said, you didn't smear enough mud and write another treatise on her, you know. So we all have all this venal aspects going on, and then the faux pas of President Bush, you know, every time he utters something, it became a regular bread and butter for the satire of the shows and all that. So the speechwriters are so integral in some perception of the candidate and so on. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. You have any thoughts about speechwriters?
Yeah, no, I think it's very interesting to mention Peggy Noonan. I think it's a very interesting writer in this context. She probably more than anyone else, except Reagan himself, created the voice that we associate with Reagan. It's become a model for a certain kind of political rhetoric, dominant on the right, but also used on the left. A figure like Molly Ivins has this same voice, and it's a populist voice. It's a voice of, if you will, artful simplicity. I'm just a simple person making simple observations, and more in sorrow than anger. That tone. This use of repeated ands, motherhood and small towns and honesty and decency. That those repeated ands. The source of that language is a certain populist rhetoric that comes from the American film of the 1930s. It comes right out of Frank Capra and his screenwriters. And I think it's an indication, and that's where Reagan gets it as well, and I think it's an indication of the way in which, in one way or another, it's the language of the left, in particular the language of the left of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, that's become the model for the language of both sides now. It's there in the populist language of the Republicans. It's there more recently in the way Republicans have very successfully co-opted and repurposed the language of civil rights, so that words like bigotry and bias and discrimination and racism and colorblind, for example, are repurposed in the service of an opposition to programs like affirmative action by Republicans. So there are these long historical movements in political language, as the same words are used by one side and the same tones are used by one side and then taken over by the other. And I think the speechwriters have a lot to do with that.
We're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. I was just thinking about the fact that an earlier caller, and I'm not sure who it was, but an earlier caller mentioned William Buckley. I think when he passed, you had to say, we're not going to see his like again. Probably ever. And it makes me think about the quality of public discourse. And I think that some people are very unhappy because they feel that it's deteriorated, not just in common, but also in what passes for formal speech making. Do you think that that is true? And do you think that that's something to be concerned about?
Well, Buckley's style, Buckley was sui generis. I have a piece about Buckley when he died, and I had mixed feelings about Buckley. He was somebody who genuinely loved words, and he loved to use them. He didn't always use them correctly, and nobody was in a position to call him on it. He would use these words like albescent and so on, and nobody actually knew what they meant, and he would misuse them, but he got away with it. But he loved language, and he loved words, and his use of this kind of language was nothing like the way the language was used by, for example, Spiro Agnew, or more recently Bill O'Reilly, with his the way he pronounces words like opine and so on, where he uses words in something like lawn jockeys, as just there's a kind of almost a contempt for language in the way in which he uses that, the clowning with language. Buckley really loved language, and I don't think that line of political discourse is dead, though Buckley made something personal of it that that we won't see the like of again. But I do think that political language has become more soundbitey, more purely emotive, more simplistic than it was. And certainly the language of political commentary, to a certain extent, has gone along with that. Mm. Although in the blogs, you see some terrific political writing. Mm.
I just, I suppose I find myself, again, thinking about people who are distressed, who say that, the way we use language has become like the way we dress now.
Well,
and that generally is sloppy all over.
I've been saying that since the 1870s. since Jonathan Swift, you know, every generation has seen the language and dress going to hell in a handcar. And, you know, if they were all right, we'd be grunting like bears today. So what the one thing you can be sure of is that 50 years from now, they'll look back on the language of the early 21st century and they'll say, boy, they really could write well then. And that was a time when political discourse was really well articulated. Yeah. And because the things that survive will not be the sound bites and the radio talk shows and the more extreme blogs and so on and so forth. They will be the thoughtful, that will be the thoughtful writing of our age, and every age produces thoughtful writing.
And do you think it is true that though over time language becomes less formal, or that it's just that it changes and that's the problem, that you're taught a certain way or your ear gets tuned to something, and then when you hear certain things, it's like the proverbial fingernails on the blackboard, and that's why people get so, and of course every individual has something different that he or she gets upset about. Is it that it, well, it just, it changes and it's always changed and there's...
Well, no, I think there are those. I think you're quite right that language has become more informal, and the history of 20th century public language is the history of the increasing informality of language. If you look at looked at the average sentence length in William Jennings Bryan's famous Cross of Gold speech of 1896, 110 words a sentence. By the time you got to George Bush's nomination acceptance speech, it was 15 words per sentence. The high Fustian rhetoric of the 19th century has yielded to a more familiar speech. It begins, you could say, with Roosevelt's fireside chats. By now, you know, with talk radio and with television, and even with the informal town halls and so on, you have something much more like conversational language. And then, of course, the blogs are writing a language that's much more conversational, informal, casual than the traditional language of the op-ed page. So this is a century-long development. I don't know that it's a bad development. What it does mean is that there's a much closer match between our public language and our private language. Time was that the speeches of a William Jennings Bryan had to be, so to speak, reinterpreted by people in their ordinary barbershop political chat. Now they're pretty much the same. And I think that's a development with very interesting consequences for the way the media work in particular. So I do think that's an important development, not good or bad, just different.
All right. Our guest is Jeffrey Nunberg. He teaches at the School of Information at University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book, The Years of Talking Dangerously. Professor Nunberg, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you very much.